Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a satellite photograph of North Korea and South Korea at night, North Korea is dark, South Korea filled with lights. North Koreans lack for everything from electricity to food to jobs, and they can't tell their stories from behind their country's closed borders. In a remarkable new book, the Los Angeles Times Beijing bureau chief takes us deep inside North Korea through the stories of those who escaped. This hour on Point, Life Inside North Korea. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine living in such a repressive regime in a country that has let its own people starve? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is Barbara Demick, Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting. Her new book is Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Nice to have you with us, Barbara. Thank you.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
And your book is extraordinary. I wish if you would start us off this hour with a short history of North Korea that brings us to where this country is today.
Okay, North Korea in a nutshell. North Korea was formed from the partition of the Korean Peninsula after the Second World War. Korea had been occupied by the Japanese, and very arbitrarily, after the abdication of the surrender of the Japanese emperor, we, the United States, drew a line through roughly the middle at the 38th parallel. Not really knowing anything much about the country, the northern half was given to the Soviets to administer. This was supposed to be a temporary arrangement. And now, all these years later, that line, that little line on a map, a National Geographic map, became the most fortified military border in the world. That's the DMZ. Hmm. North Korea is, you know, kind of a black hole in the world. We avoid hyperbole in journalism, but I really think it is the most isolated country. No internet, no international telephone service to speak of. 60 years later, no postal service between North and South Korea. During 1950 to 1953, there was a devastating war. Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea, invaded the South. The U.S. and allies came in. The Chinese came in. It ended with an armistice in 1953, and there it stands now, the war that never ended.
You have a satellite picture at the front of your book of North Korea and South Korea at night. And it is an incredible way to begin this book. Could you describe that picture for us?
Yes, it really shows the black hole that is North Korea. This is a satellite photo of northeastern Asia, and you see these bright lights in South Korea, in Japan, increasingly in China. This is, you know, the great economic miracle of Asia. And North Korea is so dark that you don't realize there's a country there. It looks like the ocean. There's maybe a pinprick of light from Pyongyang, the capital. And that's because starting maybe around the early 90s, the energy supply ran out in North Korea. They used to get fuel oil at sort of friendship prices from the Chinese, a lot of assistance from the Soviets, and their electrical infrastructure fell apart. Their generators really crumbled. They didn't have the fuel oil, and the country went dark. This was not an undeveloped country. It was, you know, quite well developed for its time. In fact, at one point, wealthier than South Korea. But it's really a country that fell out of the developed world. Mm. It fell into this blackness. Mm.
In your book, you piece together so beautifully the accounts of those who escaped North Korea. For example, a doctor, a factory worker, an orphan, among others, because North Korea is not an easy country to observe. Tell us what kind of access reporters have to North Korea.
Again, you know, I'm going to hyperbole, but I think this is really the hardest country in the world for a reporter to get into, especially an American reporter. But, you know, no matter who, actually, just for a tourist, you can only go into North Korea on a guided tour. It's a guided tour with what we call a minder. Usually we have two minders, one minder to watch the other minder to make sure nobody does anything astray. You really can't even cross the street to buy a postcard without your minder, let alone have a conversation with anybody. And as a result, the North Korean people have remained as mysterious as this black hole. The reason I open with this satellite image is it corresponds to our lack of knowledge about North Korea. We see images of goose-stepping soldiers, propaganda posters. The few people who go into North Korea see, you know, basically socialist kitsch. They see people as automatons dancing and singing in homage to the leadership. You know, we don't see the people, and I think there is almost an assumption that these are inscrutable Koreans, inscrutable Asians, emotionless, faceless. And what I was trying to do was, well, this sounds like a cliche, just show them as real people. Mm. And yes, I follow a school teacher, a factory worker, a woman doctor, a boy who comes from a very good family and becomes homeless and basically turns into a beggar, a young intellectual. They're not characters, they're real people who I know. I followed them for some years, you know, trying to get their inner thoughts to, again, bring alive this very dark place.
You talk about not being able to see the people, but you can see their leaders. The presence of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il in North Korean society, their images are everywhere. Their birthdays are national holidays. Can you speak to them and that influence over that country?
That's right. Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il are revered not merely as the leaders, but as, I guess, the closest correspondence would be the Japanese emperor or the Chinese emperors of old. They're also considered to be like family members. In every North Korean home, people are required to keep a portrait of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il on the wall. They need to keep one wall of their home empty except for these portraits. People do not celebrate their own birthdays so much as they celebrate the birthdays of the leaders. Kim Jong-il, who just had a birthday, Kim Il-sung, whose birthday will come, the late Kim Il-sung, the late founder, whose birthday will come up in April. And they're all consuming. You're taught to love them more than you love yourself or your own family.
How does the average North Korean make a living, Barbara Demick?
Good question. Well, in theory, everybody works for a state-owned enterprise. This is, you know, the last undiluted bastion of communism. This is in theory. In practicality, since at least the early 90s, people have started small markets. A lot of women, this is really a women's story, a lot of women have started businesses making tofu, making cookies, making sneakers, sewing clothing, importing products from across the Tumen River or the Yellow River, which separates China and North Korea. So there is an underground economy that's probably larger than the official economy. But the regime has been trying to stamp this out very aggressively and has tried to close the markets. But, you know, I'd say the main source of income is these private markets.
And not only, as you say in your book, do people work long days, it's also followed by hours of ideological training at night about North Korea and its history and its leaders.
Yeah, that's right. One of the people in my book, her name is Mrs. Song. I call her the true believer. She worked at one of these factories, at a garment factory, and she would start work before 8. She had 5 children, raised her children, went to the factory, would work till 6 or 7 at night, then go to ideological training. And she continued to work for this factory even after the factory ran out of fabric, ran out of thread, ran out of electricity, ran out of salary. People are often working in factories and other companies that don't really do anything. But they can't shirk their work duty. It's, in fact, in North Korea, if you don't show up for work, you can be put in a detention center. There's a big detention center in Cheonjin, the city that I write about, that was originally for people who didn't show up for work. So no matter that your factory isn't functioning, you've got to go.
You go anyway. Yeah. There's such richness to your book, and we'll get more into it in our next segment. But as we go to break here, I wish you'd tell us about the title of the book briefly, Nothing to Envy.
Nothing to Envy. Nothing to Envy is a children's song, and it's probably the best-known song in North Korea. It's really what children sing the way we might sing Happy Birthday or Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. I won't insult your listeners by singing it, but the full title is We Have Nothing to Envy in the World, and this is central to the ruling philosophy of North Korea, that this is the greatest country on the planet.
We actually have the song, Barbara, and we'll play it as we go out into the break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour with Barbara Demick, Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting. Her new extraordinary book is called Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Barbara, you describe the most horrendous living conditions for the average North Korea Korean. I wish you'd speak for a minute about the food supply or the lack of it, and the horrible conditions under which people try to find food. What were the worst years of the famine in North Korea?
The worst years, I think, were the mid-90s, maybe 97, 98. People in North Korea were accustomed to getting their food through a public distribution system. This was the great promise of Kim Il-sung, that everybody would eat rice. And the food disappeared. And the people in my city, Cheonjin, were living in a city. You know, a city is basically a concrete jungle. And they really had to, you know, use every bit of creativity to find something to eat. People went to pick grass. They went to the ocean to try to find seaweed, which disappeared very quickly from the beaches. They looked for shellfish, which also disappeared. They started eating frogs. Then the frogs disappeared. They would eat insects. They would try to catch birds, which was very difficult. There are, by the way, almost no birds left in North Korea, strangely enough, because they've been caught. They gave up their staple food, which was rice, and began eating corn because it was cheaper. But they would take the whole ear of corn, the husks and the cobs, everything, put it through the grinder, due to horrible, indigestible substitute foods, they called them. People would sometimes pick kernels of corn, undigested kernels of corn, out of animal excrement. You know, you sometimes hear people say that those in communist countries are passive, but these people weren't passive. They tried everything to survive, but it just wasn't enough.
You describe many North Koreans as being very short, with large heads. This because they're obviously not eating enough. There's a 28-year-old pediatrician, Dr. Kim, one of the people that you interviewed. She talks in the book about working with children and looking at them. You say, you quote her as saying, they would look at me with accusing eyes. Even four-year-olds knew they were dying and that I wasn't doing anything to help them. She speaks as a doctor. All I was capable of doing was to cry with their mothers over the bodies afterwards. She speaks about the hospital in which she lives becoming so strapped that it was unheated. Bandages were fashioned from cut-up bedding, beer bottles substituted for IV pouches. Obviously, that's a hospital setting, but it goes to the larger picture of the neglect of the people. Is it still that way?
I think it's not a lot better, truthfully. North Koreans who I've spoken to have said, you know, this is not the height of the famine anymore. People are not, you know, dying on the streets, but they're dying, you know, quietly at home. And one of the things that Dr. Kim told me, and I think this is well known, is that in a famine, people don't just drop dead of starvation. They die of preventable illnesses. They become very weak from malnutrition. A lot of children especially developed terrible intestinal blockages from eating these, you know, quote-unquote substitute foods, the corn cobs, the leaves, the grass. And I know that's still happening. I've talked to North Koreans who've come out recently, and it's, you know, it's the same.
And interestingly, in the book, as I read, it was often the people who would break the rules of the government who actually had enough to eat.
That's right. That's right. This is what Mrs. Song, my factory worker, told me. And she really was. She was such a good girl. She wasn't just a true believer. She was a good girl. She never, you know, met a rule that she wouldn't follow. And what she realized eventually was that if she listened to all the rules about not stealing food and not trading in the market and being a good communist, she'd die of starvation. And she told me that. She said it was the good and kind people who did exactly what they were told and shared those their food. They were the first to die.
Let's go to a call now from Chris. He's in Baltimore, Maryland. Chris, welcome to the program. You're on with Barbara Demick.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I have a question about the, if there is such a thing as a ruling class in North Korea, would it be, you know, the army, the military people who hold that? And how do their lives fare if you were able to measure that? How do their lives fare as opposed to, you know, the rest of the civilian people who have, you know, next to nothing?
Chris, thank you. Thank you. Barbara, there is a well-defined class system in North Korea, as you say in your book.
Yes, Chris, that's actually a really good question because people think of communist countries as being classless. But North Korea actually ranks people by their loyalty to the leadership. There's about 30 classes and, you know, divided in there, the core class, the wavering class, that's sort of the middle class, and the hostile class. The hostile class being people who have, you know, a bad class background, former landlords, former families of Christian ministers. One of the people in my book, this young woman, was part of this low class background because her father was from South Korea. But the people at the top are at the top because they're loyal to the leadership. And, you know, it's a combination of members of the Workers' Party, the equivalent of the Communist Party, top members of the military, not the rank and file. And they do have special housing. They have more food. They get to live in Pyongyang, the capital, which is sort of a Potemkin village, looks much better than the rest of the country. I mean, all told, their lives, honestly, are not that great, but they're a lot better than the rest.
And how does the government assign housing in North Korea? Is it also by class?
It's by class and by job. If you work for the railroad, you might live in railroad workers' housing. There's different, you know, housing blocks. And in theory, you're not supposed to buy or sell real estate. That started to break down more than 10 years ago, and they're always trying to, you know, stamp it out. But in theory, your housing is all assigned based on your job and your loyalty. Miran, this young woman in my book, who was part of the lower class, mm-hmm. Her father was a miner, and they lived in what they called harmonica houses because they were little chambers, like a harmonica, one next to another. Mm-hmm. And apartments are generally considered higher class. Mrs. Song, my factory worker, who is married to a Workers' Party member, she had an apartment, and she was very excited because her apartment had an indoor toilet, which was very unusual.
Let me ask you some questions about the economy as it is in North Korea. The military has recently, as you know, grabbed nearly complete control of the nation's state-run economy, and the North Korean government recently made everyone trade in their currency. What was the impact of that inside North Korea, Barbara?
Well, this was, in theory, a currency revaluation, but what it was confiscating the money from the people who are working at the markets. They with very little notice, just 1 week's notice, the end of November, early December, said, we're revaluing the currency and you can trade in your old money, but only up to about $100. Hmm. And this was devastating because all these people who had been working on the markets, as I described, like Mrs. Song, who was, you know, barely supporting herself baking cookies, all these people have to deal in cash. There's no credit cards in North Korea. You can't put your money in a bank. You know, they kept cash to buy food in China or do their business. And so their money was essentially destroyed. And for the first time that I've heard of, there have been credible accounts of, I wouldn't say dissent, because that's too strong a word for North Korea, but protest, people protesting at a local level, protesting to market management to, you know, ban them from trading. I've heard reports that police officers were murdered because they were trying to crack down on the markets and enforce these currency rules.
And what was the effect of the uprising? Did it make a difference?
Interestingly, the North Korean government backed off a little bit. They twice raised the limits for how much money people could turn in. And we've heard reports. I always say it with that caveat because it's still very new and we don't really know what's going on, but we've heard reports that they eased up on the closure of markets. They had ordered the markets closed. They've been doing this for a couple of years. And, you know, as I said, it's devastating to these women who are supporting families. Mm. Last summer, I met some people from another town in North Korea who had just come into China to try to trade, and they were all in tears because the North Korean government is saying, you know, you have to only buy North Korean goods. You can't buy at the market. But North Korea doesn't make anything. At least it doesn't make anything that people need, like food or shoes or clothes. Or
why do you think there hasn't been more of an uprising, Barbara? I mean, you think about, you know, for example, the wall coming down between East and West Berlin. I mean, these things happen, and how come a similar insurrection hasn't in North Korea, where people are literally starving?
There's a couple of things. I mean, one, the system of controls is very strong, and North Korea has a system of punishing an entire family through three generations for the misdeeds of one. If you would protest or, you know, do something out of line, your children, your parents, your brothers and sisters, their children, your nieces and nephews will also be punished. And one of the people in my book, Miran, said to me, you know, if people had one life to live, they might get rid of it to challenge this government, but they don't want to make that decision for their relatives. And that's a very powerful means of control.
Here's another call, Barbara, from Nashville, Tennessee. Will is on the line. Hi, Will. Welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
Thank
you. Really appreciate your work and effort. Part of my family escaped East Europe back in the 80s, our related family. And you look at the extremism of Stalin, who was and Lenin, who were the predecessors of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. And then you look at the Taliban. You look at both these groups that have suppressed women. When you told me about what they were doing to go after these women that are trying to just do a trade, and, you know, you get their agenda, which is to make some kind of dream world, socialist, whatever, with this guy's God, and then you look at, and I'm not talking about just Muslim extremism. I'm talking about the extremism. I mean, look at they kill their own people. more than they do, you know, too. I mean, it's the women there. It's people who even speak out. People lose their jobs and even just start to halfway question Kim Jong-il. I've heard some other tales. I followed it over the years, being a graduate student in education and looking at multicultural and general events.
It is extraordinary oppression, Will, and I so appreciate your call, Barbara. Did you see it related to women, perhaps more than the general population?
Well, I think it is affecting women right now because the women have sort of, you know, taken more of a role in the economy. You know, there's a very funny thing in North Korea. When they started allowing some market activity, they only allowed older women, usually over 40, at one point over 50, to work on the markets because they were considered the most disposable members of society. The men had to continue working at their state jobs at the factories, and the younger women also. Women do work in North Korea, and the young women had to go to the factories. So these older women, who you know really are like the lowest element in the North Korean class system, the ajummas, or they call them, named for auntie or married women, you know, started controlling the money, and I think they are going to be the ones who are disproportionately hurt.
I'm curious of all the really heart-wrenching stories that you tell in your book and of all the people that you interviewed, those people who escaped North Korea and the oppression there, what story hit you the most personally? What's the headline story that comes to your mind when you think about everything that you heard about North Korea?
Oh, I'm going to give you two answers. I know that's cheating. The first, just going back on the subject of women, most of the defectors who come out of North Korea are women, and the reason is they have something to sell, which is their own bodies. And a woman, Mrs. Song's daughter, for example, who was married with two children, was so miserable and so hungry. She did what tens of thousands of North Korean women have done, which is they go to the border and they find somebody who will, you know, give them the money and help them cross the river into China. And the deal is that once they get to China, they'll agree to be married or coupled with usually with a farmer. And they have no choice in the matter. So what you see is often educated women who are so desperate to just eat that they'll leave their own children behind and sell themselves. And this is still happening. And when I meet these women, I'm just astounded. They live as refugees in China with, often they have babies, and often they're rounded up and sent back to North Korea. And the level of desperation to get out.
Barbara, I'm going to have you hold that other story because we're going to take a break here, and we'll come back after this break and hear it. We're talking about life in North Korea. We'll go out on the North Korean song, My Country Is Best. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about North Koreans who escape North Korea. We're speaking this hour with Barbara Demick, Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting, and her new book is Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Before the break, Barbara, I asked you to tell us your most powerful stories, those that hit you the hardest personally, and I'll give you the chance to tell us your second story now.
Okay, thanks very much. The title of the book is Nothing to Envy because of this myth. The North Koreans are taught that they have nothing to envy and that their country is the greatest. And I was very struck by Dr. Kim, this young woman doctor in my book, who was also a true believer, very loyal to the government, and she left North Korea in 1998 only for one reason, which was that she was hungry. She was, in fact, on the verge of death. Doctors were not getting paid. She was quite an honest person. She wasn't corrupt, and she had really no other skills than practicing medicine. She'd been scavenging for food, but she was on the verge of starvation, and she decided to cross the Tumen River into China to try to get some food, perhaps from a relative on the other side. And what she told me is she waded across the river in March, half-frozen river, and came out to the Chinese side and found a village and a farmhouse, and she saw an open gate. She pushed the gate open, and she saw sitting on the pavement a bowl which had rice on it, in it, and scraps of meat. And she was astounded because she hadn't had meat in years, and she hadn't had white rice either in years. And she couldn't understand it. And then the dog started barking at her, and she realized this was the dog food. And she said at that moment she realized that dogs in China ate better than doctors in North Korea. And she was still dripping wet from the river. She'd been out of North Korea maybe less than an hour. And the whole myth shattered. And she realized that her entire life had been a lie. Everything was a lie that she was ever taught. She'd intended to go back to North Korea, and of course she did not. And that has happened in some form to every North Korean who leaves. And you know, it's not only that they're starving in their country, but their whole lives when they're in North Korea are supposed to have meaning. They're supposed to be undergoing this hardship for the greater good of this country they believe to be the greatest in the world. And when their whole lives fall apart and, you know, all their illusions are shattered, it's a devastating thing. And so there's no really happy ending when they get out.
Let me ask you more about those who escape North Korea, because often the next stop after China is South Korea, at least for those who have enough money, as you say in your book. What happens when North Koreans reach South Korea?
Well, they're really, as I say in one chapter, they're strangers in the homeland. The North Koreans believe it's part of their propaganda, and it was true that they're all Koreans, one nation. But they get to South Korea and they're completely baffled. I mean, first of all, these people have lived like Rip Van Winkles. They've never used a mobile telephone. They've never driven a car. They've never used an ATM. North Koreans tell funny stories about themselves, that they come to South Korea and they put their shoes in the refrigerator because they haven't seen a refrigerator. They see this thing with shelves, the cabinet with shelves, and they assume it's for their shoes. But it's very difficult for them to adjust, especially the younger generation. There was a study done some years ago by UNICEF and the World Food Program, and they measured North Korean defector children who have just come out. Mm-hmm. And they found that the heights were of an 18-year-old were about 5 inches shorter than a South Korean. That's a 5-inch difference in height. This is between North Korean defectors at age 18 and their South Korean counterparts. So for the younger generation especially, you know, they're not only emotionally different, they're physically different. South Korea is a very heightist society. It's good to be tall. And, you know, they're short. They often have this syndrome where their heads are very large relative to their bodies because their bodies are stunted. And it's very difficult for them to feel at home.
Well, I also was interested to read that South Korea provides North Koreans with about $20,000. Is that correct? But it seems from your accounts that there's trouble holding on to that money. Is that not true?
There is. Actually, the South Koreans now give the money to the North Koreans in stages. They give them like a resettlement package.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But first of all, the North Koreans know nothing about business, and many of them have lost the money in pyramid schemes and all sorts of problems. But they also usually try to use the money to get their relatives out. You know, with enough money, you can. There's all sorts of ways of getting your family out of North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not through the regime, but, you know, get smugglers to try to bring them out. And they often lose that money. And so, you know, there they are with no skills, no money. They have
nothing.
A very difficult time. Mm. Yeah, nothing. And it's actually some defectors have admitted to me that they regretted coming out.
Let me bring a caller into this conversation now. Beth is on the line from Earhart, South Carolina. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, Jane. Thank
hi.
You. This topic is so heartbreaking. We're so fortunate, despite all of our problems here, we are so fortunate to be in the United States. My question is regarding perhaps if there's any correlation between what happened with the breakup of the Soviet Union and the grassroots effort that began there with the residents that couldn't, that were so constricted and so, you know, dictated, that perhaps what's the possibility of something like that beginning in North Korea with defectors having left, and perhaps if they can get back inside and begin something like that, would it be so quickly and severely put down that people are afraid to attempt even that?
Beth, thank you. Barbara Demick.
Beth, that's a good question. I don't think people from the outside can make this country collapse, but they can do things, and there are efforts. You know, part of the staying power of North Korea is keeping the people entirely isolated, and this place is like hermetically sealed, or at least it's supposed to be, and that's how they maintain this nothing to envy myth. And so people are sending in things, you know, DVDs, radios. There are groups that are trying to broadcast radio programs into North Korea. And this isn't necessarily, you know, propaganda programs, just, you know, anything. You know, any glimpse that North Koreans have of the outside world is very corrosive to the regime. And this is part of the struggle. This is why North Korea doesn't open up and, you know, try to do business the way China does. They can't bring in foreign investment because that would involve foreign people. But, you know, again, there are grassroots efforts to get in information. I mean, information is the key to weakening this regime.
Here's another call, Barbara, from Springfield, Massachusetts. Chris is on the line. Thanks for waiting, Chris, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Some of the differences, when I was a child, I lived in Taiwan. My father worked for an electronics company there, but Chiang Kai-shek ruled with an iron fist. I mean, you didn't meddle in politics. The husband of our housekeeper was doing 20 years for being an opposition party member.
Mm-hmm. So you remember what that kind of a life was like. Chris, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Here's another call from Salt Lake City, this one from Jamish. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello, Jane. Yeah, this is Jameis Johnson from Salt Lake City. In 1982, I was a Fulbright scholar to the University of Bucharest when Romania was a very repressive communist country. And I had a couple of questions. For the speaker, I recall that really virtually everyone we interacted with was frightened to speak with us. But there were 6 Fulbright exchange students, and they sort of flocked to us. But really, really very carefully and often in secret ways. Is there any kind of exchange program that is being undertaken by the nations of the world? There was the IREX program that had exchanges with the Soviet Union and the communist countries. I found it very effective to sort of get information and exchange cultural sort of ideas. Does something like that exist?
Good question, Jameis. Thank you for calling.
They have occasionally brought North Korean students to Europe and to Britain. I don't know that there have been too many who've come to the United States. And those programs are a bit controversial because, you know, we've had at various points sanctions against North Korea. But I personally agree. I think they're very successful, even if the people who come out of North Korea are part of the ruling class. You know, any exposure they have to the West, I think, is very beneficial. So I am in favor of all engagement programs.
Here's a call, Barbara, from St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Dave is on the line. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Are there any groups working along the border that are able to help at all? And finally, what do you see to be the eventual outcome here?
There are some groups. I wouldn't say groups. They're almost like individuals. It's very difficult. China does not really support this kind of activity, but there are some primarily Christian groups, some Buddhist groups working along the border in China. And that's the relevant border because, you know, the DMZ is more or less impregnable. The eventual outcome, you know, I think it will collapse. I don't know when. But
you do? You think the North Korean government will collapse?
Yes. I think it will be very difficult for Kim Jong-il, who's in his late 60s, not in great health, to pass on power to a third generation. I mean, this is the longest reigning, you know, communist dynasty in the world. I mean, actually, it's the first hereditary dynasty. But for it to go into a third generation, I think, will be very difficult, given the state of the economy and given that Kim Jong-il's designated successor apparently is one of his younger sons, Kim Jong-un, who's still in his 20s. And I don't see the regime having staying power. But, you know, then again, you know, in the 90s, it was a matter of absolute faith that North Korea was about to collapse. Mm-hmm. And it never happened. So,
and what might a potential collapse mean for South Korea, do you think?
I think this is what the South Koreans are terrified of. I think they're not worried about North Korea attacking. They're worried about North Korea collapsing and having this enormous burden of 22 million hungry, homeless cousins to be assimilated into the modern world. This is not like East and West Germany. The contrast economically between the Koreas is probably at this point 20, 30 times greater than it ever was between East and West Germany. This is going to be a very expensive process, and it could be very messy. North Korea, which is a nuclear-armed state, has a lot of potential to go down in a dangerous way.
I thought it was so interesting in your book, Barbara Demick, to read that the people who successfully escaped North Korea were often unhappy when they settled down in their new homes. Several
That's
of the
right.
people that you interviewed ended up at the bottom of society. Why, and what are the hurdles that they faced?
Well, it's very difficult for the people who are educated in North Korea to go into their same jobs. Dr. Kim, who I've spoken about quite a bit, her medical credentials weren't recognized. She had to start all over again. She just graduated from medical school, I think, last year, but completely started from scratch. This young couple who I've written about, a lot of the book is a love story. The young woman did okay, maybe because she was a woman and she married well, but the young man who was a scientist really was not able to apply his skills to life in South Korea. And there's a big, you know, downward mobility, but there's also this tremendous burden of guilt because they've left relatives behind. Often the families are punished for having somebody who defected. And, you know, there's this survivor guilt. Miran, who's the school teacher who now has two children in South Korea, you know, talks about how when she was in North Korea, her pupils, who were kindergartners, were dying of starvation, and she wasn't able to help them. And survivor guilt is a terrible thing. It reminds me a lot of Primo Levi, who I think he wrote in Survival at Auschwitz, that the people who survived always felt they did something wrong, that they knew in their heart of hearts there was some sin. And I think many of the North Korean defectors feel that way.
And in our last 20 seconds here, Barbara, what would you wish people to know after spending so much time researching and interviewing people? What do you wish people to know about those still in North Korea?
You know, gosh, this sounds like such a cliche. I'm almost embarrassed, but that they're humans, and they have, they have psyches very similar to our own. They love, they fight, they laugh. They're not so different.
It's an incredibly powerful portrait. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you, Barbara Dimmock.
Thanks so much.
The book is Nothing to Envy: Ordinary Lives in North Korea. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.